Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on SheffieldLive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome morning. To the Life Sense Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. On digital if you're in South Yorkshire or SheffieldLive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. We're here every Saturday morning from 11 until 12. We've got Julian Pauly live in the studio as usual. Bit cooler today, thank goodness.
Yes.
Later in this hour, I'll be talking to RPG. Normally, every week we have a guest speaker, but Gareth's on his summer recess, as was Ogo last week. So hopefully they'll both be back with us in September. Next week, all being well, and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Chris Dale. He'll be talking about the Italian diet, which was once held up as one of the best types of diet, the Mediterranean diet, but now they've got a big problem with obesity. All sounds very familiar, doesn't it? So a bit of a roundup of general news in the science news in this week.
Well, you probably know about this already, but anyway, nearly three quarters of England are now in drought. The Environment Agency says this flash drought will have widespread impact on farmers, gardeners and rivers that could last into the autumn. It follows the driest July on record. New areas moving from prolonged dry weather into drought status are the East Midlands, Lincolnshire, Kent and East Sussex and Solent. And the South Downs.
Yeah, well, we're nearly in autumn and there's still no sign of rain.
Well, maybe Monday night, Tuesday, and maybe Thursday.
We shall see. We'll see. Meanwhile, this is another interesting one. England's rivers, lakes and coastal waters remain in a challenging state, with only around 1 in 7 classed as being in good ecological condition, according to the first comprehensive assessment of their health in 6 years. And no single waterway passed a separate test by the regulator for chemical pollution. The Environment Agency, or EA for short, said this is because legacy substances such as heavy metals and so-called forever chemicals, also known as PFAs, are building up. The biggest individual problem is phosphate, a nutrient from sewage and farm runoff, with around half of rivers still exceeding safe levels. Despite a record £22 billion earmarked for water company environmental improvements by 2030, the overall picture has changed little since 2019. Other types of pollution affecting England's water bodies include antibiotics, petrol, garden pesticides and contaminated water running off roads, picking up microplastics and chemicals. Water UK has called for the use of forever chemicals, which are also known as PFAS, to be banned to limit their build-up and reduce water treatment costs. But these types of chemicals are currently used in thousands of products from school uniforms to medical devices.
School uniforms? Don't get
it's
that.
It's the fabrics to make them stay cleaner, I think, longer.
Yes. So, electric dreams. Now, I can't quite get my head around this sort of stuff. Driverless taxis could be coming into the streets of the capital, says Transport for London, has now granted licences for a fleet of autonomous electric Ford Mustang Mach-E vehicles, that's M-A-C-H-E vehicles, operated by Uber using technology developed by British startup Wave, that's W-A-Y-V-E. The first of their kind, the approvals are contingent on a human safety driver being behind the wheel. I mean, some people can't drive anyway.
Well.
With additional permissions still needed before the cars can operate fully autonomously. If successful, they could pave the way for a wider rollout of self-driving taxis across the capital.
Yeah, I don't think taxi drivers are going to be very happy, are they? Another one in the press.
We haven't finished yet. No.
Oh, I'm sorry, Paul.
The announcement has reignited familiar concerns about safety and whether we are ready to hand over the steering wheel to artificial intelligence. Yet, history suggests today's unsettled innovation often becomes tomorrow's everyday convenience. We will see.
Well, it's like computers, isn't it?
Yes.
Mobile phones and things like that. Yeah, another great story in the press this week. Any dog lover will tell you their canine friend picks up on their mood and emotions. Now, scientists have worked out exactly what is going on inside a dog's brain when it sees a human, even a complete stranger, smiling or scowling. The research involved 14 dogs in total who all sat very still in a brain scanner while they were shown pictures of people's faces. Photographs of happy, smiling human faces made an area of the brain that is associated with reward light up with activity. The dogs were shown images of strangers' faces with different expressions. In previous research on dogs, the same brain region has been found to light up when dogs anticipated a tasty snack or smelled a familiar person. It controls us having motivation to do things, wanting to do things, explained Laura Cuea, one of the study's lead researchers at the University of Vienna. So this finding suggests that happy faces, even those of strangers, have a positive value for dogs. Co-researcher Raul Hernandez-Perez went on to investigate how dogs responded to other human emotions, showing dogs images of people displaying happiness, anger, fear and sadness. But the reward circuitry only responded to happy faces. Dogs can distinguish between positive emotions and all the others, but they don't seem to be able to distinguish between the different negative emotions. They were both from the University of Vienna. That's Laura Cue and Raul Hernandez-Perez. They're actually partners in research and in real life and something of a canine cognition power couple. After meeting at secondary school in Mexico, of all places, the two went on to work together on research projects that have revealed how dogs interpret and respond to human language and behaviour. It is work that has revealed insights into the biology underlying the unique relationship between humans and their dogs. The researchers explained that from a neuroscience perspective, the dog's brain is quite fascinating. They are really good at understanding emotions in humans, a species that is completely different from them. This research is building a picture of exactly how thousands of years of living alongside humans has made this possible by moulding and changing dogs' brain circuitry. When we compare humans with other primates, we are looking at abilities that may have come from a common ancestor, the researchers said. But with dogs, the story is totally different. They followed a very different evolutionary path, but through domestication, they developed the social abilities needed to understand and cooperate with us. The findings of that research were published in the journal iScience. Track there from the Stooges, of course. Iggy Pop was in that band. I Want to Be Your Dog. Can you believe that's from 1969?
Yeah,
great track. Play that. To talk about research that's just been released in the journal iScience about how dogs respond to happy faces, not just from their owners, it's from strangers too. So make sure you smile at your dogs or other people's dogs. Of course, listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We're here every Saturday morning live from 11 till 12, talking about science in all its different forms. Next up, another great article by Paul Simons. He does an article in, I think, Saturday Times it is, called Weather Eye. And here he's talking about the Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities. And if you tuned in last week, you'd have heard me talk about that from another article by a different researcher. But in this article by Paul Simons, he starts out by saying Vincent van Gogh's painting The Starry Night is mesmerizing. A turbulent, swirling night sky dominated by a huge spiral. Even though this seems to be a highly surreal picture, similar swirling patterns can be seen in nature, such as wave-like clouds, ocean waves as wind blows over the water, and most recently, whirlpools of plasma detected on the surface of the sun. And we talked about that last week. All these worlds are created by the turbulence of Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities, discovered and developed in 1868 to 1871 by Lord Kelvin and Hermann von Helmholtz. Such turbulence is uncannily similar to the Starry Night and could have been the inspiration for Van Gogh. Other ideas have been proposed, including that the turbulence in the Starry Night represented Van Gogh's state of mind when he was when he made the painting during his stay in a mental hospital in Saint-Rémy-de-Provence in the south of France. In that time, he made 150 paintings, and he could see the night sky through through the window in his room. But Van Gogh's picture may actually have nothing to do with stars. John Barrow, the Cambridge mathematician and astronomer, recognised that the picture was very similar to the spiral shape of the M51 galaxy, nicknamed the Whirlpool Galaxy, and John Barrow came up with an intriguing theory. The spiral structure of the M51 galaxy was revealed in the 19th century by William Parsons, the 3rd Earl of Rosse, using his large 72-inch reflector telescope at his home at Burcastle, County Offaly in Ireland. At the time, this was the largest telescope in the world, and when he made a sketch of the galaxy, it was widely published in newspapers and magazines and featured in a book, Popular Astronomy, by Camille Flammarion at the Paris Observatory. Van Gogh was well-read, and even in his mental asylum, he could easily have seen a copy of Parsons' sketch. So it's highly conceivable that the Starry Night was inspired by the Whirlpool Galaxy. All very interesting. Before we continue, I just want to say that Phil Muffett from the Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society, they held an event at their observatory at Hoover this week. I think they advertised it on Facebook because obviously Wednesday night we had the partial eclipse, and then later that night it was the Perseid meteor showers, and 150 people turned up to the observatory at Hoover, and I think an absolutely fantastic time was had by all the photographs that they've got from, you know, proper equipment. And, of course, people have viewed the sun, viewed the eclipse safely. Paul was saying that there was a lot in the press the day after that partial eclipse where people were struggling with their eyesight. Clearly, they'd not followed guidelines.
They were searching the internet
for problems solve, with their eyes. So well done to Mexman Swinton Astronomical Society. They had 150 visitors. They viewed the sun safely. You want to see their pictures, you can check out their website, msas.org.uk, or follow them on Facebook. They put some great stuff up.
They're going to need a bigger car.
They're going to need a bigger observatory. But brilliant. And that's the beauty of public outreach. And I think they've done a fantastic service to astronomy, and they continue to do that as well. And they also got a lot of donations as well, which is fantastic. So anyway, brilliant track now, all related to galaxies, Whirlpool galaxies, Wawal galaxies even. We'll be right back. marvellous stuff from the one and only Mr. Bill Nelson. Yeah. War War Galaxy number one, and that was originally played at his Nelsonica 04 event back in 2004. And we couldn't resist playing the whole track And we were talking, we played that because we were talking about the Kelvin Helmholtz instabilities. And the Whirlpool Galaxies, all good stuff. You're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. On digital, if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning from 11 till 12. Sorry. Next up, an absolute belter of a story in the Times last Saturday. Wagyu of the Sea swims back to UK. The article was done by Adam Vaughan. And it was all about bluefin tuna have returned to British waters, delighting biologists, but also delighting chefs. And there's a bit of a Sheffield connection here as well, which we're very pleased about. Great article. Giant bluefin tuna are better known for record auctions in Tokyo, where fish weighing more than 200 kilograms can sell for millions of pounds. Now, British chefs and diners are celebrating a jump in the amount of top sashimi-grade tuna coming from British waters. Fishing crews serving Brixham Fish Market in Devon have been bringing in up to 12 bluefin tuna a day since the licence season began last month. A year ago, the number was just two a day, and for decades, the world's biggest tuna species has been absent in British seas. The catches are a blessing for high-end diners who can look forward to seeing more dishes containing the Wagyu of the Sea in coming weeks. It is the latest boon for Britain's fishing industry, which has already benefited from a gold rush of new octopus populations moving to UK shores. The tuna fish have moved in now. We're starting to see numbers of them, said Barry Young, Managing Director of Brixham Trawler Agents. The number of licences has doubled. There are more boats doing it, so we're expecting more tuna this year to come across the market. Bluefin tuna are worth thousands of pounds each. Tuna landed at Brixham this season have weighed from 60 kilograms up to, so far, 135 kilograms. The fish usually sell for £7 to £12 per kilogram. Some are sold for as much as £22.50 per kilogram. Many are caught in the southwest off the coast of Cornwall, Devon and the Isles of Scilly. Some have been caught far into the channel off Jersey. Now, Shetty Chavan, the only fisherman from Jersey to win a bluefin tuna licence, caught his first on July the 25th. He said it was a great feeling and he would donate the money from his first catch to charity. Some of those turning their hands to octopus in UK waters have been making £20,000 a week. But the initial small limits on bluefin tuna mean it's potentially for the fishing sector has gone largely unnoticed. Most of the bluefin tuna caught today is destined to end up as iron dishes in British restaurants. Mount Street Restaurant in Mayfair, London, features the fish on its seasonal menu where chefs post videos deep frying it before serving it with seaweed mayonnaise. I'm not sure about that, but chefs at Fallow Restaurant, also in the capital, freeze the loins to make it easier to slice before carving it to serve slices at their raw bar. I'm a huge lover of tuna, particularly bluefin, because it's so fatty and it's got so much umami, it's delicious. The texture is absolutely unbelievable, and that is according to Luke French, who's chef and co-owner of Joro Restaurant in Sheffield. They actually won the first Michelin star earlier this year, I think it was. And I think they're the only restaurant in Sheffield that holds a Michelin star.
And where are they exactly?
They're at Uterbridge, old paper mill, I believe. Wow. And they're doing incredibly well.
You can stay over, can't you, as well?
You can, so there we go, at Joro. He said, so Luke French, chef and co-owner of Joro Restaurant in Sheffield, woohoo! We will utilise the entire fish. Literally, nose to tail, fin to fin, we'll use the bones, we'll use the skin, we'll use everything. And that's a reflection of a lot of chefs now using every. If something's going to be killed to eat, then you should use everything, no wastage. Ricky Weston, the executive chef at Whatley Manor Hotel in the Cotswolds, said, I think it's easy to forget just how amazing produce actually, how much amazing produce actually comes from this country. West said on part of the appeal fire in the restaurants was the storytelling involving the tuna, such as the names of the fishermen and their boats. Bluefin tuna has a long history in the UK. In the 1930s, can you believe, the Yorkshire coast, particularly Scarborough, supported a world-renowned recreational bluefin tuna fishery that drew wealthy anglers. However, the population collapsed in the 1950s. Guess why? In part because of the decline of mackerel, which they prey on. So there's a big sustainable issue. It's not just about climate change. It wasn't until 2014 that they were seen again in significant numbers. Dr. Katie Smith, a researcher at the Marine Biological Association, said warming seas were one reason for their return. A 15-year international conservation plan launched in 2007 is also believed to have played a key role. Sea temperatures are projected to rise further. There is a high likelihood that we will continue to see more bluefin tuna in UK waters. It makes you wonder what else, octopus, bluefin tuna, what else is going to come our way. An abundance of local prey has also helped too, said Tom Horton at the University of Exeter. A research project he conducted found 65% of tuna solely ate one of three small oily fish, anchovies, sardines and sprats. Those fish are part of the foundation of the marine food chain. With added pressure from the tuna, close monitoring will be needed to avoid accidental over-exploitation of the smaller fish, which could cause their populations to crash and then force the bluefin tuna to migrate elsewhere. So there's a really important story there about the food chain. And there are 30 commercial vessels licensed to catch bluefin tuna, which is double the number last year. Each is allocated a limit of 4 tons, an increase from the three tons limit last year. From those hoping to get a rare taste, Brooke Schliff of the Good Fish Guide Ratings, run by the Marine Conservation Society, said bluefin tuna is more likely to be served near where it is landed in Devon and Cornwall. It can also be bought via specialist fishmongers and online retailers. Brilliant story there, and also linked back to Sheffield because Luke French, the co-owner of Jorah Restaurant in Sheffield, is one of the chefs using bluefin tuna caught in UK waters to make high-end dishes.
All right, here we go. I'm dancing!
Another great track there, Swim by Fishbone from 1993. Sure, we played that. Was talking about the return of bluefin tuna to UK waters. And we've also had before that a lot more octopus. Very interesting story. Of course, listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 until 12. We should have had PG on the line. Good morning, PG. Oh, he's not there. Oh, technical issue. Come on, Paul. Press the button. Are you there, Paul? Try that. Are you there, Paul? Oh, we might have to just play a bit more of the Beatles and try again.
Yes, we just don't know what's going on.
We don't know. Never mind, it is live radio. These things happen.
Here comes the sun, and I say it's all right.
Paul.
Hello.
Oh, we are there. We've done it. We've got very technically accomplished now, Paul. We've whipped the lead out of the laptop and plugged it into the phone. There's no stopping us, Paul.
Wowza.
We've got you. Brilliant. So, tell us what's caught your eye in the science news this week then.
Oh, well, a bit of a strange one, but some different news from one of the water companies. And it's local, would you believe? We've all seen the panic about hose pipe bans and all the rest of it, but this is the discovery near to Sheffield of some rare breeding bats. And they're roosting near to Sheffield Reservoir in Woodland, and they're Nathusius pipistrelle bats, confirmed as Yorkshire Water site near Sheffield. Has been the first time they've been recorded in South Yorkshire. So environmental DNA collected from the bat box in March indicated the animal's presence, and in April one was physically spotted in another bat box nearby. So the lead ecologist at Yorkshire Water, Sean Davey, said the bat boxes on Sheffield site were installed only 9 months prior, so it's encouraging to see them quickly being adopted by multiple bat species. And the bat boxes were funded by Yorkshire Water's Species Conservation Programme and installed in 2025. And they're designed to mimic the natural features that bats use for roosting, enhancing their habitats and helping bat populations thrive on the sites. So he said that the DNA swabs were trialled by an ecologist from Yorkshire Water and helped by the South Yorkshire Bat Group. He said the bat boxes and other known roost sites were swabbed to collect the eDNA samples, revealing the presence of a rare migrant bat. And the company said that monitoring the bat boxes on the site helped to confirm conservation measures are working and could highlight unexpected and valuable results, like this appearance by the Nathusius pipistrelle. And they said that using eDNA swabs was potentially a useful monitoring tool. I think they swabbed the area to see if they can pick up DNA from different bat species and then check it off against records that they've got of that. So they said that some data could easily be missed in one-off surveys, like a visual check in the bat boxes. So this helps to zone in onto new creatures that are taking up habitation in the bat boxes.
Do they think there are new species? Is it because it's warmer?
They're not sort of conjecturing on that. They're just happy to see them, I think, is the point of this. So they're saying that since they started working alongside the South Yorkshire Bat Group and the biodiversity intelligence company called Nature Metrics, who provided the analysis of the eDNA collected from the bat boxes, and it was them that actually detected the signs of the Nathusius pipistrelle, and it's one of the UK's rarest breeding bat species, and it's also known to migrate long distances between the UK and Europe. So finding that they were there was later confirmed by follow-up surveys and the first confirmed roost of the species in South Yorkshire.
Wow.
So, interesting news, and done by one of the water companies, so maybe a small sort of offset from...
For all the rest of the stuff that's happening, Paul.
Yeah, some of the other gripes.
Something positive, yeah.
So I thought it'd be nice to sort of look into that. Looking about that, again, some news coming through about the RHS, Royal Horticultural Society, and the possibility that they move the plants that they stock up to the north to protect them from the heat, because the south and southeast has been particularly stricken by the heat. So they are considering moving the plant stocks to somewhere in the north where we're somewhat cooler, but not that much.
Apparently today Edinburgh's 27.
Yeah,
or something, because it hasn't been that warm, and Cardiff's, I think, copping for it as well, so that they're getting a little bit of it. But it's an interesting one, Paul, because if you read in the press, the RHS, Royal Horticultural Society, garden centres are just basically failing because people aren't buying plants, because you can't water them when you buy them. And
well, there's a strange thing with that, because also sort of hidden away in the sort of small print, I think, for the hosepipe ban in many places, is that there's a 14-day window if you're buying new plants that you're allowed to hosepipe water them.
Really? Well, how do you know? How do you know how old they are?
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing. I think if you've got your purchase receipt and it's within the 14 days, and you caught watering with the hose pipe, then apparently that's a dispensation, but only for newly bought plants.
Yeah, but you know, newly bought plants, they're not going to establish in 14 days if you have continued drought.
No, I think...
It's interesting. I suppose it's for the garden centres, otherwise they're not going to sell anything, are they?
Well, that's it. I think they've got to strike some kind of a balance. And I think, again, revelations of the billions of litres of water that are being sort of lost to leaks in the system. So I think, unfortunately, there are lots of signs around of where things have tried to be eased along with fast fixes. And I think that one of the things that they did for a lot of the sewage and water systems was to feed what they called pipe sleeving inside. So large plastic pipes that were designed to fit within the normal sort of built structures that were there to carry water. But unfortunately, we've got many thousands of miles of connecting pipes, and the maintenance on them has been really lacklustre for a century or more. There's sort of so much of the infrastructure that we've got in the UK, we're still clinging to the work of the Victorians. So if you think the Victorians sort of disappeared with the change of the into the 20th century, you know, we're now in the 21st, so it's 100 years and more that we've relied on ancient sort of infrastructure. And amazingly, in places you can still find things like the foundation that were the Roman systems. So it'll take you back a millennia, if you like.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
You just see it's very difficult. And again, a country that produced railways and exported them around the world, now we've got two accidents because they think potentially of the heating of the rails has caused a couple of derailments in the UK, which have had some injuries and pushed a couple of trains where they've lost carriages off the track. So it's very difficult, and I think that the planning for somebody like the RHS to duplicate their plants as the stock. I mean, we talked about the preservation of biodiversity through seed banks in the past, where we put them into a place where they can be refrigerated and kept cool and extend their life, so that in the event of something like these wildfires, potentially you can start to access seeds to restart growth. And in disaster, I mean, the changing environment, they're doing research on a lot of ancient cereal grains to see if they're going to cope better with the new environment that we're in. So it's kind of an interesting move to take the plants and store them further north. But as we again spoken on the programme, now the vineyards are creeping much further north than they used to be in the UK due to the warming of the...
Yeah, and some places in, you know, in France and Spain, they're probably too hot now.
Yeah, it's...
It's crazy, yeah.
It is a sort of proof of climate change. And again, there's so many sort of scientific sceptics around the world who will give you lots of reasons why it's not. Things like, oh, well, you know, it's a cyclic thing that will come round and then it'll disappear and go away again for another couple hundred years. So it's not the end of everything. It's just the normal sort of rush of things that happen. So that's kind of really, I think, the sort of local stuff I saw. But then I guess there was a small event this week, wasn't there?
A small one?
Yeah, I think the thing about the eclipse of the sun. It was quite interesting to observe some of the pictures I saw. I did try the colander projecting saw some of the eclipse, but it was very confusing and not very well sort of presented. Certainly, I hadn't researched it anywhere near enough to make sure of what was happening. So, like a lot of people, but apparently it did cause a sellout in lots of areas of colanders.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, I guess that's the cloud and the silver lining again on a lot of things. But Well, what I did see on some of the images, and it's probably me feeling hungry at the time, but when it was getting close to be fully eclipsed, on the leading edge down towards the bottom part of the image, there was a sort of a red sort of small thing, which to me looked like a lobster crawling up the edge of the eclipse. I thought, probably feeling a bit peckish.
Are you not sure you're not hallucinating from looking through a colander, Paul?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that was the problem, because I remember somebody who I won't name watching it with me, who thought that you put the colander over your face. Which didn't quite work. But, well, we did give it a try anyway. But I thought, well, it you know, this sort of red thing was a solar flare, which stood out because it blanked the real direct sunlight, so you could see it in more clearly. And as the eclipse progressed, it seemed to progress up the image of the sun and moon together. So it sort of made me wonder about things. And I found an interesting article, which was about the Indian sort of space projects. And they're saying that their solar missions are now finding new findings to throw light on the enduring mysteries of the sun. So it said in the article, one of the most enduring mysteries that's been puzzling scientists forever is how the sun's outer atmosphere, the corona, can be millions of degrees hotter than its surface. And how does the corona continue to remain so hot, despite there being frequent eruptions during which the sun loses huge amounts of energy? So astrophysicists in India now say that their latest findings from their mission, the Aditya L1, the country's first solar observation mission, have provided some vital clues to unlocking the mysteries. So their findings revealed in a recent paper published in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. And it says that the temperature variation in different regions of the sun defy the laws of physics.
Oh!
So they say, according to the leading Indian solar astrophysicist, Professor R. Ramesh of the Indian Institute of Astrophysics, who led this study. And he said, if you cut through the sun's layers deep inside the core where the temperature is 15 million degrees Celsius, and then travel outwards to the surface of the photosphere, as it's called, the part we see from Earth, there it's about 5,500 degrees centigrade. And far away from the core is the sun's outermost layer, or the corona, where the temperature can be about 2 million degrees centigrade, but sometimes progressing up to double that to about 40... 40 million degrees centigrade. So Professor Ramesh says the corona is where extreme weather events such as solar flares, i.e. my little red lobster, and the coronal mass ejections originate, during which time large amounts of energy are released by the sun into space. And these coronal mass ejections cause beautiful auroras. And they can also affect life on Earth by causing geomagnetic storms that can knock out power grids, affect weather and communication satellites. So in normal and low activity times, the sun launches 2 to 3 CME events a day. And during maximum solar activity, the cycle, which comes around every 11 years, there can be 10 or more in a single day. So if the sun's losing such huge amounts of energy, it's not replenished, the star at the centre of our solar system could lose all its energy and Earth will be plunged into
doom, Paul. It started so well about Yorkshire Water and the bats and ecology and everything.
But the good news is that since it's not happening, it means there must be a mechanism by which corona is able to maintain its inexplicably high temperature. And what they say is down to two factors. And that's that there's a bubbling, boiling motion on the sun's surface that constantly generate waves as they travel outwards, which carry energy to the corona. So it's a bit like the sea carrying foam and froth onto the shore. And the second, they say, is the tangled magnetic field lines. And in the sun's atmosphere, these constantly snap and then are reconnected. So Professor Ramesh says that the events occur when these twisting, looping lines, which resemble braided hair, rupture, throwing out massive clouds of magnetized plasma and gas into space. And they often originate near sunspots, which are darker and cooler spots on the sun, where magnetic fields are particularly strong. Then these lines reconnect, and the sun replenishes the lost energy within hours. So they're saying, why is 2026 going to be a year like no other for the Indian sun mission? And how important are the India's moon mission's findings? And why is it costing India so little to reach the moon and Mars? So in their paper, Professor Ramesh says they've been able to quantify how much energy each of the two systems provide to the corona, which explains both and why it's many times hotter to begin with and how it retains the temperature after consistently losing energy. So the study says it clearly shows that the second system that supplies most of the energy, and it says that's through these waves generated as a result of the bubbling, boiling motion, and that the sun's surface generate and transport energy, their contribution is very little. They supply only about 7% of energy requirement, and the remaining 93% comes because the sun reconfigures itself and replenishes lost energy. So it's not constantly burning away, it's a case of it burning and then reconstructing itself to maintain its position. So they arrived at a calculation where they studied the very energetic events that took place on the 5th of August, and the emissions were recorded by the coronagraph, which they call the VEB, Visible Emission Line Coronagraph. And they saw that in 8 hours after the CME event, the tangled field lines were able to go back to their original place. They reconnected and the corona's energy was reconfigured. So they say they don't recognise that energy generated by bubbling motions plays a major role in it, but they do have evidence that it's not sufficient. So the study shows that the magnetic field lines snapping and reconnecting everywhere on the sun are the primary source of supplying most of the energy for these events. And that data, Professor Ramesh says, provides an important benchmark for the future studies of the potential energy generation mechanisms in the sun's atmosphere. So a long explanation for a little...
But all good stuff, Paul. And we did actually manage to talk to you.
Yeah, which absolutely.
Is brilliant. And you wanted two songs. Well, we sort of brought you in with Here Comes the Sun, which funnily enough I was singing on the way in as I cycled, so yeah. You must have known, bit of telepathy there. But we're going to play out with another banger of a song related to sunshine. What could it be?
Oh, I don't know. Walk on it.
Walking on sunshine by Katrina in the Waves. All Ooh, good stuff there. Brilliant, Paul. We'll speak to you Monday, Glory Days Rock Show 1 till 3.
Right, look
forward. Bye bye, Paul. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.